Hello, everybody. I want you to meet a close personal friend of mine. His name is Morning Mane. He's the fuckboy fail son of a demonic dynasty who'd rather lose himself in a haze of substances and rampant hedonism than manage his family's vast empire of wealth and power. His family and Morning himself are fiends, half-human, half-demon creatures hidden through every strata of our world and in possession of dark magic born from buying human souls. This is the World of the Calamities that I'm telling you about, a new novel by Chuck Wendig, best-selling author of The Book of Accidents, and the beginning of a brand new dark fantasy series. Morning has always struggled to accept the legacy of cruelty, domination, and exploitation, and his father exiled him for it. But now, Daddy wants a word. Apocalyptic plans are in motion, and at his terrifying father's command, Morning must decide whether to accept his legacy or forge his own destiny, and with it, change the course of the world. The Calamities by Chuck Wendig is available everywhere books are sold. You know what else is available? That's right, Fangoria, which has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible, and delivered right to your door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a massive 25% off of your subscription. That is Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes dead is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Eric Vespi, and I am here with a brand new episode. There's a new flick coming your way that I believe is right up the alley of all the weirdos that listen to the show. It's called Buddy. It's about a 90s children's show icon who might not be as nice as he seems. We'll get more into that in a second, but it's all from the twisted brain behind Adult Swim's Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, the Cheddar Goblin commercial in Mandy, and the guy who earwormed the world with his almost psychotically catchy Too Many Cooks. To explain himself and to dive into a little Stephen King nerdiness, I give you all writer, director, producer, and madman, Casper Kelly. Welcome to the show, Casper.
Hi, Eric. Happy to be here on the KingCast.
We are very happy to have you. I think we were talking right before we started recording about a chance encounter we once had in Georgia via a mutual friend named Scott Poitras, who is a great character actor. He's one of those faces that you saw in pretty much any genre movie you liked in like the mid-aughts through the mid-teens. And love that dude. And obviously he keeps good company if he introduced the both of us. So
yeah, so, Scott's amazing.
Yeah, he's a very cool dude. He introduced me to some amazing barbecue over there. And I say that as a Texan, and I got to get this out of the way right now, because Texas barbecue still kicks the shit out of everybody else's barbecue. And I got to like lay that down now. But he took me to a place called Fox Brothers, I believe.
Yes.
And they had fried ribs, which I'd never had in my life before. And I know this isn't the rib cast, but I got to point out that that was some of the most delicious cooked meats I've ever had. So I have to bow down. This Texas barbecue boy has to bow down a little bit to the talents of the Georgia barbecue.
I have. Well, thank you. my dad's a Georgian. My mom's a North Carolinian, and I grew up in Eastern North Carolina. So I'm also a big fan of the North Carolina barbecue, vinegar-based barbecue with coleslaw on top on the sandwich. Right. And I've long had a dream. I'm going to manifest this with your audience,
please,
of getting a getting a map that maps the locations of the different styles of barbecue. Would be a fun map to have on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah, because it is, you know, and I've had the Carolinas barbecue too, you know, but to me, barbecue is beef, and like, you can't get around, you know, I don't know. It's like even before the Austin barbecue craze happened, you know, the slow cooking, the Terry Blacks and the Franklin of it all. Before that style became prominent, like we still had Lockhart, which is all very beef based barbecue.
Yes, so I've never been to Lockhart. Yeah.
Yeah. And listen, I love a good, you know, pork rib and all that. This is the most bonkers way to start off a horror show on the Fangoria Podcast Network, by the way. Unless we were talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
We just started fighting and I just leave in a huff on arguments over barbecue. And then there's also, I have a friend who lives in Kansas City. I haven't tried their barbecue yet, but have you? Do you have a hot take on the...
Nah, I mean, listen, in order... I kind of subscribe to the, again, to the Texas barbecue of, like, the meat's got to be the thing. So if you can't eat it without sauce on it, then it's not cooked right. You know, it's not seasoned right. It's not cooked long enough. So all the very saucy barbecue, and listen, I have saucy barbecue that I like here. There's a place called the Salt Lick, which I used to love taking people out to because it's kind of out in the boonies. I remember I took Edgar Wright out there whenever he came out, like back in the old days when Shaun of the Dead, when he was kind of carrying that around with him. And I took him out there and it was like, he got in late and I picked him up from the airport and I drove him out. And this is like out in the boonies and he had never met me before. And he's like, is this guy, you know, I'm coming to Texas for the first time. I look out, I just see pitch blackness. We're not in the city anymore. Like, is he going to bury me out into the country somewhere? But that's part of the experience. You go out into the middle of nowhere, you eat this crazy good food and they, it's a mop barbecue. So they mop it with sauce all during cooking and the sauce is, you dump generous portions of it. So listen, all this is to say, I am pro sauce, but you know, I also adhere to, if you can't eat it without the sauce, then it's not done right.
I'm going to agree with you on this.
So much of the other barbecue is about that. We are going to officially change this to the food cast now,
the
on the Food Network, podcast system here. But yes, this all comes out from the point of I in a weird way I associate you with good barbecue because Scott introduced us and I think he was the same day he took me to Fox Brothers. So, but I am very excited to have you on here. You have an absolutely bonkers movie coming out August 28th. That's called Buddy. Explain yourself. How do you even start with something like this? This is one, it's so in your wheelhouse, but you know, you do something a little bit different here where you have that great like 90s aesthetic that you are kind of known for, but you also pull out into the real world at a certain point. It's really interesting to see that dynamic. So can you talk a little bit, without spoiling too much of what's going on here, can you talk a little bit about your approach to making a feature that kind of plays into your talents without also having to fill a feature length runtime?
There's so much to say here. Unlike most of my movies, or most of my work, which is my own idea, this was a germ of idea of doing a Barney horror movie, was presented to me by J.D. Lifshitz at Boulderlight, who is the madman who made Barbarian, Weapons, but then also Friendship, and then Companion.
Right.
So they have quite a track record. And he had wanted to do a Barney horror movie and thought of me. And I was not sure about it at first because mascot horror is a pretty established subgenre. And I feel like just the novelty of something cute with a axe is not enough. But then I started thinking about it more, and then I started figuring out new directions to take it and new things to do with it, and hopefully to make it scary and funny, but also give it some depth, give it real emotion. And then also, hopefully, if the audience wants to, it's about things that they can discuss afterwards. And then secondly, I think I'm learning about myself that maybe it's insecurity, but I really do try to put everything I can into a movie, and in everything in the kitchen sink, like I don't, I'm a maximalist, you know, I just want to put in as much as I can. So I love to zig and zag. So, and you talk about the buddy world and the real world, and there's probably like actually three other worlds in there.
I didn't want to spoil things for the
listeners. Sorry.
No, you've spoiled it and spoil away. That's your job. I just didn't want to be the one to do it.
Don't worry, audience. I'm going to try not to be spoilery.
You talked about the germ being this, like, you know, what if horror movie Barney. And it's really hard to not see that. But I also see, like, you know, there's a lot of Pee-wee's Playhouse in there. You know, I guess this is such a fertile ground because kids' TV is inherently creepy. Like, it's like when you're a kid, it's not, but you can go back and look at even some Sesame Street. You can look back at, you know, what was the trio? My little brother, I aged out of it, but my brother was born in 91. So I had my generation of kids TV, you know, that was like, you know, He-Man, and it was, you know, Mr. Rogers and all that stuff. And then I got the second win with my brother, 'cause he was 10 years younger than I was. There's Lamb Chop. There was the one I'm trying to think of. There's like the three middle-aged, like, hippie people that would like the skidamarink-a-dink-a-dink, skidamarink-a-doo. And they would like, there's something very culty about a lot of these performers here. And so, you know, what, you know, have you figured out what it is that's so creepy about children's programming?
It's a good question. It just depends. So I'm Gen X, so I grew up more on Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers and Electric Company, but also all that crazy Sid and Marty Krofft stuff. And then I kept tabs on kids television, but then when I had my own kids, that's when I learned to dove into Barney and Dora the Explorer, the Backyardigans, Blue's Clues, Doodle Bops, all that kind of stuff. So there's something about, well, it depends. Like, I think Sesame Street is actually very human. I guess being Henson related, I think that's probably less creepy, but, obviously, Sid and Marty Krofft is very creepy, partly because of the designs do not match the innocent. But even Land of the Lost, they had these aliens, these lizard aliens called the Sleestaks. They were so creepy, and it made me wonder if they knew something and were trying to reveal it to us. But then later on in the 90s shows, the kids got a lot more behaved and a lot more controlled, I think, and everything got sanitized a little. And that is a little creepy, too. It kind of feels very slightly culty almost, you know,
right?
Where everything just runs so smoothly.
It's how you talk to kids, too, right? And I don't know. It's not necessarily creepy when you see a parent talking to their kids in the way that these people talk to kids, but it's also the stranger danger aspect. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right.
There's something off about it, and
But also, like, and take Barney, for example.
Right.
As a little kid, when I watch stuff, I'm like, where do they sleep? Do they leave this park to go to sleep? Where are their parents? Do they go to the bathroom? Like, where's the bathroom? Like, I was a weird kid.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of maybe feeds into your approach here, because I want to make it clear that Buddy is not a guy in a suit in this universe. This is like, it's like if Barney, you know how they have those like x-rays of Barney or whatever, where it's like you see the dinosaur, you know, bones underneath if you x-rayed him instead of like just the dude that was in the suit, which I guess is a whole other bag of worms.
Let me jump in there. I'm glad you brought that up. That was I don't know who the artist is that does that, but that was a huge reference point, because he would do the skeletons for like the Powerpuff Girls.
Right.
And it would look horrifying because it was these little limbs and then this big head with these giant eye holes, you know. Or even like Bugs Bunny or et cetera, any cartoon character. That was a huge touchstone.
Yeah. There's just something otherworldly about it. So, like, again, I think it's a pretty, It's a good setting for a horror thing, especially when you know, lean in, at least for the stuff for me that I really grabbed onto, the Pee-wee's Playhouse of it all. You know, your yes. Cherry and Conkies or not Conky, Wally's and, you know, Clockies and whatever are a little slightly different. But I do love this whole conceit where everything that's in this happy universe is just scared as shit of the thing at the center of it. And so it's ridiculous. It's weird. You know, there's a, maybe I can say that there's an escape that happens and we get to see what exists beyond the walls of these kind of shows. And that to me sounds like it was super fun. And you get in a really great cameo in here in this moment. I don't know if you want it out there who it is, but
thank you.
And so there's, I don't know, it's way bigger than you would expect if you've just seen the trailer or read the description. So I want to point that out.
I'm joining you guys in process. Very
hello,
sorry
hello. Jump scare.
I, very sorry to to join you late, Casper. I had the wrong time. I thought we were talking at noon Pacific time, so forgive me.
No worries. Good to see you.
But I'm gonna explain my absence by instead claiming that I was knocked on my ass by this movie and have not recovered yet. So I was seeking medical aid. But your movie truly made me no longer believe in God. So well done.
Put it on the poster, Casper.
Flattery will get you everywhere. Yeah, that's a great blurb. Yes.
This, I'll say it on the record. This movie made me stop believing in God. But carry on and I'll catch up.
It made me believe in a different kind of God, I think. I'd love to talk a little bit before we move into the Stephen King-y aspects here. I'd like to talk a little bit about the aesthetic. I know this is probably something you're bombarded with, you know, going back to the Cheddar Goblin thing in Mandy or, mm-hmm. you know, Too Many Cooks. There's a nostalgia that you're able to hook into, whether it's an 80s style commercial or a 90s style feel, you know, and this is all over Buddies. So can you explain a little bit about, like, what's the secret of making that feel authentic and nostalgic for certain folks? Like, is there something that you lean on, you know, that makes every one of these kind of feel authentic, or is it just you go by with your gut and what your memory is, and that's just how everything plays out?
I think it's a mixture of love and OCD-ness. I'll tell you a story about another thing I did. I did this little skit for Cartoon Network based on this old 60s Hanna-Barbera show called Birdman. Mm-hmm. Not Harvey Harvey Birdman was also based on, but it was a 60s show. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make it look like a scene from that show. And it was a mixture of old animation and new animation. So mm-hmm. I had to make the new animation match the original animation. Mm-hmm. And we were doing all these things and learning all these things about blurring the pencil lines and everything. And it still wasn't right. And then we figured out what it was there was a thing called gate weave. When a film strip is going through a projector, mm-hmm. it kind of sways slightly. Mm-hmm. So I was like, yes, we need the gate weave on the new animation to match the old animation. So I guess I just have a OCD quality about that.
And attention to detail. Yeah.
Well, what was it that you also are just excellent at capturing this? Things that are supposed to be pleasant and benign and sort of junk food satisfying and making them malignant and toxic. That's really at play here too. Definitely got a sense of that from Too Many Cooks, where it's just a pitch perfect imitation of a kind of sitcom that gradually begins to warp and go into a dark place. And that's very much what happens in the Buddy show as well, isn't it?
Yes, you got me there. Yes. But then it was fun also. I mean, there's other things that I'm referencing later on without being too spoilery. I get into Wizard of Oz and a little Night of the Hunter, which is a movie I love and is one of the best Children in Jeopardy movies. So it's nice to pay little homages to them in new ridiculous ways.
I didn't track Robert Mitchum in Buddy, but now I do, now that you mention it.
At a certain point, Buddy just wants a hug, right? So, I mean, the hugs aren't something the kids want. But it's, and speaking of, like, something you share in common with one Mr. Stephen King, who is the namesake of the show, is you kill some kids in this movie. Like, and Stephen King doesn't shy away from killing kids. So what is the value of murdering children in your fiction? Go.
And this answer will follow you in the future.
Yes.
For whatever political career
Pick your
you
words
intend
carefully.
To run, but carry on.
Well, these days I think I probably won't. It might help me politically. I think it's just trying to tell an honest story with danger in it. So I treat it the same as if it were with adults. These kids are in a perilous position and there's real stakes. One thing that I have to think about, that's one thing I want to talk about, is different mediums. You can get away with different things. Right. Like in a novel, you could maybe get away with killing a kid, but in a way it might be too much in a movie. Or you could maybe get away with it in a cartoon, but if it was a live action movie, it's too much. Like if I but maybe not. Now that I'm saying it, I'm going to disagree with myself. But like, if you had a log smash a kid's face in, that might be too much, you know. So it's sort of feeling out what feels right in the movie to scare the audience, but hold on to them, you know. But
there's something even more. Like, I saw preteens torn limb from limb in Welcome to Derry. Mm-hmm. But in the setting, the bright studio lights of the Buddy TV show, which is so much like Barney or Howdy Doody from a different generation, there's something even more disturbing about this sort of fluffy creature taking them out. And I notice you, whenever there is a death, you're much harder on the adults than you are on the kids. The kids tend to, you know, get swallowed without too much of their viscera emerging, or you cut to the other side of the fence when something bad goes down. I don't want to give away too much of what happens, but there's a sense of looking away, maybe.
You know, you bring up an interesting point that like a 24-year-old playing an 18-year-old is the absolute primo cannon fodder.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the number one age that we see get mutilated in horror movies.
Yeah.
But going down to 10, which mm-hmm. I guess is even younger than it, I think, I would guess, is a little different. But then again, I don't mean we go for it. I mean, there's some death, there's some blood flying around. So
I kept thinking, well, maybe they'll come back, but no, they're gone for good.
There's, again, stakes. We have to have stakes.
Yes.
And that goes back to our barbecue discussion at the beginning of this, which, all right. So Kristen Milioti, how did you talk Kristen Milioti into being like, what's the pitch? How do you go to her and be like, okay, have you ever seen Barney? Let's start there. Like, so how do you talk, Kristen into,
well, I have to give, her agent credit. This script was kind of circling around and her agent really responded to it and felt like it was good for Kristen. And Kristen was interested, but she's actually not a huge horror fan.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a horror movie, but it has also different modes. It has some modes that you could sort of compare a little bit, maybe to Goonies or to Close Encounters, you know. So she liked that it had different. Like, I don't think she would want to be in a Saw type movie. But this movie, which mixes a decent number of genres, I think got her interested. And then I had a brunch with her, which was very magical. And I was very nervous, of course, but I felt like, wow, I feel like a real director. I'm doing the classic breakfast in Los Angeles to persuade someone to be in my movie, which I've seen and heard about time and time again. So it was a pinch
Robert
me
Altman
moment
movie right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love Robert Altman. That's a big, I love Robert Altman.
Hey, y'all. Vespi here, once again to remind you about today's sponsor, Penguin Random House's upcoming book, The Calamities. To refresh your memory, it's from best-selling author and former KingCast guest Chuck Wendig. The story follows Morning Maine, and that's M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, by the way, who is described as a fuckboy fail son, wonderful descriptor, of a demonic dynasty who'd rather lose himself in the haze of substances and rampant hedonism than manage his family's vast empire of wealth and power. His family and Morning himself are fiends, which are half-human, half-demon creatures who are hidden throughout every strata of our world and in possession of dark magic born from buying human souls. This is The World of the Calamities, a new novel by Chuck Wendig, best-selling author of The Book of Accidents, among other things, including the great Aftermath series of Star Wars books. This guy knows his genre stuff. He's been at it forever. And The Calamities promises to be the beginning of a brand new dark fantasy series by him. The main character, Morning, has always struggled to accept the legacy of cruelty, domination, and exploitation, and his father exiled him for doing so. But now his daddy wants a word, apocalyptic plans are in motion, and at his terrifying father's command, Morning must decide whether to accept his legacy or forge his own destiny, and with it, change the course of the world. The Calamities by Chuck Wendig is available everywhere books are sold from Penguin Random House. Now let's get back to the show. So it doesn't escape me that that Buddy chases people around with an axe in this, and whenever we were kind of throwing out titles, The Shining was one that you said was actually a pretty big inspiration for this. So are we
Go ahead. Sorry,
I was going to say with the axe, I assume you mean the Kubrick adaptation more than the novel, but is it both?
I love the novel. I like the miniseries, but I do love that movie. But what I want to talk about that was talked about a lot was when I first had the outline for this movie, the producers wanted to see a little less of the interior life of Buddy and make him more unknowable, like Mike Myers is in Halloween. And I felt that wasn't the right approach because as a character in the show and an authority figure, we know him, or we at least know one presentation of him. You know what I mean? Like, he is the main character of that show. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
So the example I gave them that helped satisfy them was The Shining, where we know, and really the movie I referenced the most because that was the easiest to refer to, but we know that character, and that character is a mixture of scary, pathetic, absurd, funny, vulnerable, and empathetic in some ways. It's all those in one, and it makes for a fascinating movie and book that we're still talking about all these years later, and it's very rich. And it's a rich thing to explore. And I love movies like Halloween and Friday the 13th. Although, and they've gone on to develop their backstories a little more. I like the idea of understanding that a villain, and you know, kind of seeing where the villain's coming for a little bit too, even though they're horrible and wrong.
I think the mystique of a slasher is a little bit, it's a different beast, as you're saying. Like, the more they explain Michael Myers, the less scary he became.
Yes, yes.
But you're not making a Halloween movie. You know, Buddy isn't meant to be the lurker in the shadows, the blank face that you can project all your greatest fears onto. Like, you know, that's not, Buddy's a giant, you know, fluffy, multicolored unicorn, you know?
Yes.
You know?
But he is wearing a mask. I mean, it is a big fluffy mask, and even the voice itself is kind of a mask. This sort of upbeat yokel voice that that Buddy the Unicorn deploys is not his true self, and it's just a different kind of mask.
That's a brilliant observation.
Thank you.
That's the second time today that I've heard observations that I'm like, oh, that's great. I wish I'd thought of that, but that's very true.
I tracked The Shining thing right away. in early in the movie. Again, I hope this isn't giving too much away, but the first sign that we get that this this sort of children's playtime world is not so great is when Buddy is trying to get one of the kids to put their shoes on, and he starts to lose his temper just a little bit. And I thought, I'm the dad of two kids; they're older now, but I remember those days. Like, we got to go get your shoes on. Just stick your leg out.
Yes.
And that's what Stephen King wrote The Shining about, was he would lose his, he realized he was losing his temper. I don't think he realized at the time that alcoholism was such a huge part of his own experience, but later he's acknowledged that. And he says he was worried about losing his temper when you're a dad. And that's a real thing every dad goes through, whether you chop your kids with an axe or a mallet or not. Everybody loses their temper. Everybody gets frustrated. And so that, I thought it was really smart of you to show Buddy not immediately stabbing people with a unicorn horn, but just getting kind of pissed off.
You know, yes. That's a great observation. That's something I really love about Stephen King, is that he may not have been aware of the alcoholism component of The Shining. Forgive me, Eric, did I already mention this quote about authors? My day's a blur doing press. But there's a quote I love that if you want to know what a novel's about, the last person to ask is the author. Meaning that, you know, they're working with their unconscious. So it might be a blind spot about what it's really about. And I think that obviously King works intuitively. He famously does an outline and he just lets his unconscious go. Subconscious go. And I think that's very beautiful and hopefully creates very rich works, because, you know, our subconscious is smart and wise in strange ways we're not even fully aware of. Another good example of that, I suspect, is when especially horror genres come into popularity, and it's sort of tied to a fear that society is going through at the time. For example, famously, you know, alien invasion movies in the 50s were really about
Red Scare.
Yeah, the Red Scare, or like Godzilla was really about, you know, the A-bomb going off. Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating to see all that at work and how our subconscious sends us coded messages that we later interpret it.
You do layer quite a bit of mystery still, like, this is not a movie that ever truly explains itself. Another parallel to The Shining is that bizarre scene that we all remember watching when we're young, where Wendy looks down the hallway and there's a guy in a bear or a dog suit kind of having sex with another guy. And, and the movie never goes, by the way, this is what was happening there. It just leaves that with you. And you're like a little weirded out. You know, I guess this is pre-fur. Even though we know what furries are now, I'm still weirded out by that. I think it's okay to not understand some things. But you, again, don't want to go too far into the back end of this movie. But there's a point where they go into the worry well, and I'm like, who the fuck are these guys down here? Like, what is happening? And you don't offer comfort by way of explanation in this movie.
I love that aspect of movies. Now there's an amount, like, you have to know enough to appreciate the story
to follow along.
Yeah. But I want there to be mystery and curiosity. For example, in Star Wars, but any executive hearing this, I would love to work on Star Wars. But in Star Wars, early on, when they talked about the Clone Wars, that was so exciting, and it created a mystery in your head of what could that be. Mm-hmm. I almost don't want that. I don't want to see that. Mm-hmm. I want to just speculate about it. It's like a nice, mysterious thing, you know?
It's like a space to play. Yeah. It's like an empty space that you can fill with whatever you like.
That just enlivens the whole world. I mean, and David Lynch was famously with Twin Peaks was always trying. He's like, I don't want to solve the mystery. I want to add more mysteries. And I like that. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have some kind of answer or else people get frustrated. That's just how the world works. But, you know, I think that, you know, the other side of that is getting them invested in the characters in front of them, and then once you do that, then the world, as long as it doesn't feel like it betrays itself, you know, that takes care of its own thing. And here you actually have a lead kid, the one that's figuring it out, and the one that's feeling the guilt for not saving the people she can and all this stuff. You know, it's a nuanced kid character in a movie about a giant murderous unicorn. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's also something that you could, you know, make a parallel to Stephen King stuff about. Like, you know,
if you go back and reread
it, you know, every single one of those losers is fully fleshed out and flawed and real and remind you of people that you know. So I guess, you know, was that something that you knew as long as your lead girl was somebody the audience could connect with and you could get away with some of the more ridiculous stuff?
Yes. And hats off to Delaney Quinn. I really feel like she did a wonderful job. She plays Freddie, but I think it's also what they might say in comedy or acting is committing to the bit of like, I treat it very seriously. I mean, no, I take that back. I treat it very truthfully. The kid situation, even though absurd as it is, I treat it very truthfully and sincerely. I don't treat it like a spoof or a parody. And I think that allows the audience to get invested, as crazy as the story is. And I think Stephen King is a master of that too. He certainly will take a crazy premise. The Monkey's a crazy premise, you know, or the Mist, or I mean, any of them, but he just commits to the idea and then does very logical cause and effect. It's not like a bunch of random things are happening. Yeah. It's a very logical cause and effect. So you're on the edge of your seat to see what's going to happen next.
Has Uncle Steve been sent this movie?
I wonder if he'll see it. I don't know. No, we haven't. I don't even know if we know how to send it to him, but I would love for him to see it.
I mean, he loves movies. He sees almost everything, I think.
Oh, okay.
But I might be wrong. I don't speak for him, but I think he will love this because I think Buddy speaks to his twisted sense of humor. Whenever he tries to be funny in a movie like the opening sequence of Maximum Overdrive, I think is hilarious. It's all right. Slapstick comedy, but slapstick comedy that has actual consequences to it.
Yes, like, yes.
You know, it's like the people in Maximum Overdrive, like what would happen to the Three Stooges if they actually were hitting each other and gouging each other's eyes? Like that's what makes him laugh. I think he's going to get off on the sick weirdness of this movie.
That was shot in North Carolina when I was living there.
Oh yeah.
Did you bum rush the set?
No, I was too young. I would love to have done that. Yeah.
So no Dino De Laurentiis stories?
No, I think, yeah, I believe they probably shot it in Wilmington. Mm-hmm. Around the, when did that movie come out? Do you remember?
87.
Yeah. So yeah. Can you imagine if there was any overlap of that in Blue Velvet? I wonder.
There was.
Yeah. Oh, there was.
Yeah. No, go over, Chris. Yeah.
So this is, of course, Steve's first movie, first and only movie that he directed. And you're probably familiar with this shooting notion of crossing the line. The editors like to make sure.
Yes, the 180-degree rule, yeah.
You know, I think probably for the layperson, the best way to explain it is you have to shoot the movie in a way that the characters aren't looking at opposite ends of the screen. They have to be sort of facing each other, and so you have to stay on one side of a conversation. And when you switch it, it's a little bit disorienting. You can do it, but you have to be prepared for that to feel like a movement. Mm-hmm. And Steve was just sticking the camera any old place because he didn't know. He wasn't a film student. He didn't learn this sort of basic. It's sort of like he was speaking Yoda language cinematically. Like the things were just sort of out of order. And he ran into David Lynch and asked him, what is this don't cross the line thing that my Italian cinematographer is trying to explain to me? And Lynch started to try to break it down for him the way I just did, and then realized he couldn't and just said, I don't know. I don't understand it either. So there actually was crossover.
You've made my decade with that story. I love that.
What's Steve's story? He told it here on the KingCast.
Oh my God, that's incredible.
Yeah, yeah, there was I had heard a rumor that David Lynch came in and ghost directed a section of the movie. And I brought it up to people who should know, and they were just like, no, that's not what happened. So unfortunately, it's not true, but they were in the same town at the mm-hmm. same time, you know, and meeting with each other. And I don't remember if Blue Velvet was in pre-production or if it was in post, but I think it was one of those like slight overlaps while yeah. one was going when the other one was just starting or just ending.
Well, you know, there's that script going around of the shooting of Maximum Overdrive.
Maximum King?
Yeah, Max, I would love, if I got the chance to direct that, I would definitely add that David Lynch scene in there. That would be incredible.
That is such a you thing. Wampler.
Pause the movie for 15 minutes while you explain crossing the line to non cinematographers.
Yeah, I remember Wampler tried to get a KingCast live show where we were going to do a dramatic reading of Maximum King, and he went to the screenwriter, and the screenwriter is the one that fucking nipped it in the butt and was just like, nope, I've already been threatened with lawsuits, I am not going, nobody can do anything out here with this thing because I actually want to work in this town.
I have one other tidbit for you. Is in Too Many Cooks, the father in Too Many Cooks is had a role in Blue Velvet as one of the friends of the boyfriend. I think that in the scene, most of his scenes may have been cut, but all the deleted scenes are out now. But right. So that brings it full circle. There's a Too Many Cooks connection to straight to Blue Velvet, and that takes us straight to Maximum Overdrive. So there you go.
There you go. I mean, you've got King, another King connection in Patton Oswalt, who plays the backpack. What's the backpack's name again, Mr.
Strappy?
Backpack? Strappy, that's right. Patton Oswalt is the narrator of Other Worlds Than These, King's new novel that's coming up. And Patton himself gets a shout out in The Institute in 2019, the novel from 2019. And I know he's a huge Stephen King fan. He's great as Strappy. You have an amazing voice cast playing these characters. Eric Bauza is he plays several roles, right?
Oh yeah, thank you for mentioning Eric Bauza. Yeah, he's such a wonderful person and so fun.
I love him.
And Patton, I've worked with for almost 30 years, but mm-hmm. I've not really met him face to face yet. I've always worked with him remotely doing voices, but Monday I'm going to finally meet him in person. He's going to be at a screening at the Arrow in Santa Monica with me. That'll be fun. And I'm reading his Minor Threats right now, his comic.
Oh.
I love the scene where Strappy is like, do we really have to save the mailbox guy? <That's>, no offense. But Eric does, he does the mailbox, Mr. Mailbox, Worry Well. There's
some of the flowers. Yeah.
Some flowers. There's some Pee Wee Herman type characters that turn up in this world that he voices. And then you've got Michael Shannon as another character. I don't know if we want to reveal who he plays, but it's hysterical. And I don't know, maybe you've already talked about it at the top of the show, but Keegan-Michael Key is as your buddy. How did you and Keegan come together? Did you know right away who you wanted, or did he audition that voice for you?
We were discussing ideas, and then we hit upon the idea of Keegan-Michael Key, and that just seemed perfect. Right. And then we made the hard decision to wait and not send him the script, but wait until the movie was edited with the confidence that that would win him over seeing the movie. Mm. So he didn't actually even need to read the script. We sent him the movie over the weekend, and then he was on board.
And not many people realize this, but inside the suit is James Earl Jones in his last screen role.
Yes, yes.
Doing the voice, and he wasn't good enough, so you had to get a different voice.
His voice
had lost. Turnabout is good play.
James Earl Jones, he's amazing, but his voice had lost that booming depth. It was more kind of Fred Stoller-y. So, yeah, we had to recast.
So when you actually show, I'm kidding, of course, to people who are literalists out there online. Got to put a little asterisk there because Blue Sky will go insane. But when you showed it to Keegan, what was the voice like? You know, the reason I brought up James Earl Jones is, of course, David Prowse did the voice of Vader, and then they later replaced it. And so when he watched this Star Wars for the first time, it had this Bristol country English accent coming out of Vader's mouth or Vader's mask.
Which is hilarious, by the way, if you've never seen any of that.
What was the state of the film?
I'm gonna look that up.
Yeah.
So there was one of the suit actors and puppet designers, Sedwan Hooks, mm-hmm. a fellow Atlantan who constructed the Buddy doll, the little tiny Buddy, mm-hmm. among other things, is a Barney fanatic and told us how the way they did that. So the suit actor cannot do the voice. Number one, it wouldn't sound good. Number two, it's incredibly hot in there and there's mm-hmm. fans going. You have to have fans inside and an ice pack. So Barney, and also it's just very difficult because you can't see out of that suit unless their mouth is open. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very intentional and thoughtful of your body language while they're talking, because otherwise it'll start to seem like a dead character. So their hands are moving constantly. And I mean, just imagine doing a dance routine on mm-hmm. stairs with a kid when you can't see. So usually they would have a voice actor on set, but off screen doing the voices, and then the suit actor would act to it. But in this case, Sedwan did the voice acting for Buddy. And then the suit actor was this guy named Sergey, who was amazing. Mm-hmm. And Sedwan's voice is great. Like, these puppeteers are very talented. In fact, two of the voices are by puppeteers. Mm-hmm. Charlie the Train is voiced by Devin Ludlow, who mm-hmm. is the head puppet designer. And Betty Bunny is voiced by Jamaica Collins, who is Sedwan's wife.
Oh, cool. She does one of the flowers too, doesn't she?
Yes, I think so. Yes.
So that was the state that Keegan watched it in?
Oh, yeah, yeah. God, I've got way off topic.
That's all right.
Yeah. No, Keegan watched it. He was in. And then we did a lot of talking and thinking about, because he's so versatile, he could have imitated Barney if he wanted to. Mm-hmm. But we didn't want to do that. It's not a spoof. It's a, it, I want it to feel like its own show. Like, mm-hmm. like
part of a genre rather.
Yeah,
than
part of a genre. Like, once Halloween came out, this is the Friday the 13th, you know, like,
right.
Arnie is to Halloween as this is the Friday the 13th. Yeah. You know? So like that.
He's and the deep impact to it's Armageddon.
Yes. Yes. The cracks to this, it's Mad Magazine. Mm. Yes.
They go to the same dentist. I think they have that same sort of flat tooth, smile.
It was very fun to, work with him, and he was so eager, and he would be on each line, we go, okay, I'm going to give this one to you very cheerful. Now I'm going to give you one slightly irritated. Now I'm going to give you a, like, this is a one on irritation. Now here's a three on irritation. Now here's a little passive aggressive, you know, so you could really dial in the tone of each scene and the, mm-hmm. And the feeling and the structure of it. It was great.
Do you speak about the film differently with the child actors than you do with the grown-up actors? Given how young they are, they're about 10 years old, like you said.
Not really. Maybe I'm a little more clear and a little less shorthandy, a little mm-hmm. more thoughtful in describing it. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, here you're getting stabbed and you do this. Okay, you know, but I was very sensitive to this. I didn't want anybody in an uncomfortable situation. Mm-hmm. So when we cast the kids, I wrote a paragraph of like, this is a horror movie. This stuff happens. So if you're not comfortable with that, please don't audition, you know, to the mm-hmm. parents. And then I talked, and then when we started to think about who we were going to cast, I talked to the kids and the parents. So it's just being very thoughtful and intentional about that. But these kids were very sophisticated and have seen a lot. Like, I guess things is, you know, I kind of grew up
in some shit.
I grew up in the VHS age, so I had seen some shit. But now with online, I mean, it's a whole other world. I mean, right. You know, they've seen so I mean,
past Delaney, traumatized for example, children, and then what you put them through won't seem so bad.
Yeah.
At this point, it occurs to me, Casper, even though it's because we you know, Brez, what you miss is we went off on a 5-minute barbecue tangent at the very mm-hmm. top of the show. I neglected to ask you what your Stephen King origin story is. This is your mm-hmm. first time on the show. And we always ask our guests what their Stephen King origin story is, which doesn't have to be anything in depth or like specific, but like, what's the first time that King kind of popped up, you know, on your radar as a presence in pop culture?
I think I'm pretty sure it was The Long Walk, the Bachman book.
Mm, interesting.
Because it wasn't expressly horror. I was a chicken kid. I was scared of horror. So he fooled me. He got me with a pseudonym. And then, and, but that was a great book. It was so gripping. And then I learned it. Then it came out that it was Stephen King. And so, yeah, it was off to the races from there. But yeah, that was that's a great book.
You had checked into that even before you knew it was King. That's cool.
Yes, yes. Or maybe it, maybe when did that come out? It was 80s that it get revealed that that was him?
I think it that's when it was revealed.
So that would have been 88, 87, 88.
So yeah, it was that's I'm a Gen X kid, so yeah, that's I was reading Bachman before I knew it was Stephen King. And then I moved on to Stephen King too.
Yeah. Interesting.
And I think with Stephen King, I started on his short stories.
Yeah.
As a baby step, a Skeleton Crew, I remember very fondly. And Four Seasons.
Different Seasons.
Different Seasons. Different Seasons.
You're not the first person. You won't be the last person to to call. I think even Will Wheaton called it Four Seasons at one point. And you're,
did
and
he?
Like, my dude, you're in Stand By Me / The Body. You can't.
My
you,
dude.
You can't make those mistakes.
Well, he's obviously thinking of Four Seasons total landscaping and the press conferences that we had.
Oh, no. Will Wheaton connection is we both have worked for Star Trek.
No, that's true. That's very true. Just saw something. I think Jerry O'Connell got a gig in a Star Trek thing, and he had a. I literally right before jumping on here, this came across my algorithm. It was so weird, but he said the very first text he got wasn't from his wife, who was also in Star Trek, about it. It was from Will Wheaton, and you know, welcoming him to the crew.
Trek-iverse.
Yeah. That's crazy. So what's your favorite Stephen King thing? Like, do you have a thing that stands out as your favorite? Your book, movie, short story? I mean, you mentioned Skeleton Crew.
I mean,
Crew,
it's so that's hard to do. I mean, I know he hates he doesn't like The Shining movie, but I do love it. That might be it. And I get his critique of it. But it, for some weird reason, it just works. But Misery is really great, too. And that's another example of a villain where we know them intimately and know their interior life, and it's still horrifying, you know, kind of what we were talking about earlier, Eric. So yeah, that's that, and it's just relatable too. The pressures of pleasing an audience, and yet you want to, you know, have your own things you want to express, you know.
Right.
It was great. The Mist. Yeah, there's a lot.
I thought of Misery also watching Buddy because Annie Wilkes speaks in a kind of childlike way.
Yes.
Very sort of like, she uses words like duty instead of the grown-up words, and speaks kind of like a children's host or a kindergarten teacher.
That's true.
Or something.
Yes.
In the same sort of patronizing way, you know, patronizing. Yeah.
And also nothing is her fault. Everything is someone else's fault. Yeah, that's an interesting observation.
You know, she and Buddy have that kinship. If Buddy needs a new nurse, Annie Wilkes could fill that.
Annie
that
Wilkes
would be an interesting
absolutely.
Combo.
He does go through a couple of nurses in this movie. So as a filmmaker and as somebody who has, you know, read King, I always like to kind of ask folks, like, what do you think, why do you think he's had so much success in being adapted? You know, you can look at so many other authors, you know, that bigger authors maybe even than him, that, like, you know, he's outsold by Dean Koontz and Clive Cussler and these people, but their shit never just makes the jump to the big screen in the way his stuff does, and makes them, and that kind of also makes him culturally relevant. It's like, do you have any thoughts on why is it, does he just write more cinematically than they do? Is it, you know, the characters are more well-defined, so they translate better. Like what do you think?
Those were two of the things that popped in my head.
Yeah.
Is he does, but also he works, intuitively and with his unconscious subconscious, right. he doesn't outline. And I wonder if those other guys do. So it has a layer of surprise, and he's surprising himself. Like, I mean, he just clearly loves it. I mean, he writes every day. I'm so jealous of his productivity. But I guess in a way it's sort of like, there's different bands we love,
right.
But there's some bands that just, they just know how to do a melodic hook. I mean, it just hooks you in. You know, one after another. This guy, He does the literary equivalent of a pop hook, and I don't mean that. I mean that in the best way possible, yeah. Like Beatles McCartney, you know, yeah. he just can do it, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Like the Pennywise in a Drain is just, my kids had not even seen that movie. They had only seen the cover. And when we would walk the dog, they didn't want to go near drains. That's a power that's hard to defy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good warning, though. I don't think kids have any business being anywhere near drains, killer clowns or no. So
stay out of the sewers, kids.
Yes.
It's not like the good old days. It was fun back then, not so fun now.
Yeah. Well, one last thing I want to shoehorn in is On Writing is a great book, too.
So mm-hmm. good.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing that always comes up when we talk about On Writing is just how you can't read that and then not want to go write a novel.
Yes.
It's one of the most like uplifting, encouraging things. You know, the love of writing is just so attractive in that thing. Yeah. Love it. Yeah,
I think one of the thing is Stephen King is putting his real self in there.
Yeah.
In everything he does. He's not pretending to be like other people who want to try to pretend to be cooler or whatever more. He's truly giving us his honest self, and we love him, that we respond to that.
I think that's why that book caught on so well, because it was the first time a writer talked about his or her craft without trying to inflate themselves.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
He was like, this is how you build a bookshelf, kids. And it was much more along the lines of here is the craft behind the art.
Yeah. He has the confidence to be himself, warts and all. And we love people who are themselves, truly.
Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure. Well, Casper, speaking of people who are truly themselves, you and your work very clearly speak to a demented brain that I adore and can't wait to see you keep making more stuff and keep throwing weirdness out there. Although, listen, if you want to go straight for your next one and just do a completely down the middle melodrama, that's totally up to you. I'll support you either way. But
I think I'll always be weird. I think that's just attached to me.
Has anyone ever tried to make a feature length version of Too Many Cooks?
I would. Well, it better be me. I'd love to be the person to do that. Yes, that would be amazing.
God, there's got to, whatever your 30-minute twist in that is going to be something to behold if you ever make it happen. So. But thank you so much for your time, man. And good luck with the movie. Do you want to remind people when and where they can see it?
Oh, yeah. So Buddy is the movie. It's coming out August 28th. Theaters everywhere, opening wide. Please go see it so I'll get to make more movies. And I thank you very much.
Many thanks to Mr. Casper Kelly for the chat. Everybody, go see Buddy in theaters this weekend if you like messed up stuff. Once again, I must remind you, this is a feature film from the same twisted mind that gave us Too Many Cooks and The Cheddar Goblin. His particular brand of weirdness is not for the normies, and us fiends must celebrate it when something like this slips through the system. Buddy in theaters this weekend. And also, don't forget to sign up for the KingCast Patreon at patreon.com/thekingcast. You'll get access to a ton of bonus episodes going all the way back to 2020, exclusive interviews, commentaries, our Shelbyville actual play RPG apps, and you'll also be the first to hear any new ones that come down the pike. It's also the best way to directly support the show. So if you like the show, throw us a few bucks. It keeps the lights on, keeps us going. We very much appreciate it. Again, that's patreon.com/thekingcast. And that's that. Until next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself, as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.